Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
My guest tonight is Daniel Pipes, who is one of the most expert and prolific writers on the Middle East, and also on Islam and Islamism in the West, and on the problems and the prospects of the State of Israel. And at the moment, he's in California. Good evening, Daniel. Dan, are you there?
I'm here.
All right.
Good evening, Milton.
Thanks very much for joining us on rather short notice. I want to open by asking you to tell us what has happened to the Arab Spring. Clearly, the spring has sprung, but has it gone towards the democratic awakening that we were told was in process? This means a focus certainly on some of the more internally conflicted states. At the moment, Syria stands out, but Egypt is still in conflict. Lebanon, Yemen, and Israel is looking on with some trepidation, I'm sure. Give us the sort of tour of the horizon, the overview of the Arab Spring.
Sure, and thank you for the kind introduction. Let me start with a bit of pedantry. The actual major developments took place in the winter, not the spring.
Yeah.
By March 21st, it was pretty much over. All the major events. Let's go through it one by one. Libya, there is a civil war that has no clear outcome. We have sided with the rebels, and we did so without knowing exactly who we're supporting.
Do we know any more now that we've been in there for about 3 or 4 months at least?
I can't really say we do, no.
Yeah.
And so my hope for disposition in Libya is not a clear rebel victory. This is a little odd to say, but I want to see two Libyas. In fact, there are two Libyas, a Cyrenaica in the east and Tripolitania in the west, and that's what it boils down to now. Let's see who's who, and are the rebels better than Gaddafi, in which case let's help them defeat him, and maybe Gaddafi's better than they are, in which case let's help him defeat them. We've never gone to war in such a way before without knowing who we're fighting for. Very, very strange policy by the Obama administration.
Now let me
by the Europeans too, I might add.
Let's take a quick trip over across the Mediterranean, going north northeast, and we arrive at Lebanon and Syria. Let's go directly to Syria. Every day, Assad is managing to kill 10 or 20 of his own citizens.
Yeah, I suspect those numbers are grossly undercounted.
Uh-huh.
I think the prevalent number now is 2,000. I think it's I would my guess would be it's several times more.
In this, he's in the tradition of his father, who killed them by the tens of thousands.
He is indeed. Now, his father was tactically brilliant and strategically inept, by which I mean he ruled Syria very effectively for 3 years, from 1970 to 2000. No two camels could meet in Syria, Fazl Assad, knowing about it. He didn't get anywhere. It was a poor country, a weak country. He managed to stay in power. That was his great achievement.
Also, a strange country in terms of the religious dimension of its political life, the dominance of the minority of Alawites.
That's right, consisting of some 12% of the population. And historically despised, and indeed today, very much resented.
Now, a little footnote, if you would, Dan. What exactly is the Alawi version of Shia Islam? What kind of religion is that?
Well, the Alawi religion, I will call it, is somewhat similar to the Druze religion, and both of them came out of Shiite Islam.
Yeah.
But spun so far away that they're no longer recognizably Islamic. Though for religious and political it is often useful for the Alawites, or the Syries, as they're sometimes called, and the Druze, to claim they're Muslims. Just Muslims with a different theology. In fact, they're not Muslims. They are just as Christianity is not a variant of Judaism. The Alawite religion is not a variant of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
It's a post-Islamic religion. What's so striking is that Hafez al-Assad, the dictator, intended for his eldest son succeed him. His eldest son was an equestrian type, military type, and would have fit well, I think, into the role of dictator. But his eldest son, being the type he was, smashed himself up in a car and killed himself, going too fast, which left the next son, who was studying to be an eye doctor in London. And all I can say about his next son, Bashar, is that he probably would have made a much better eye doctor than he does a dictator.
Surely the only ophthalmologist ever to rule a nation of any kind.
I can think of a gynecologist. I can't think of an ophthalmologist. So he took over 11 years ago.
What's the nature of the revolt against his regime at this moment?
It's a general repudiation of everything that the Assad dynasty stands for.
Uh-huh.
From its brutality and tyranny to its Alawi nature, its sectarian nature, to poverty, you name it. It didn't begin that way. It began in March as a fairly modest attempt for reform. And it's showing true ineptitude. Bashar al-Assad did two things at once. He gave way, made concessions, and killed people. And it didn't work. It just created more expectations and more anger. And now, 5 months into it, I've seen pictures of hundreds of thousands of people out in some of the cities. And it's hard to see how we can survive. The real strategic importance of Syria changing hands would be that this is the key ally of the Iranian regime.
Mm-hmm.
Syria in itself is not that important. But Syria as ally of the mullahs in Tehran is indeed important.
And are Iranian forces in there in Syria trying to buoy up his regime or otherwise lending some kind of aid?
It appears that there are actual soldiers, there's materiel, there's money.
Sure.
The Iranians understand this and are doing whatever they can to support the Assad regime.
But you expect that they're all the same, the Assad regime is ultimately doomed, do you?
I think the chances are pretty good that the regime is doomed. And I think this is a real blow to the Iranians. And the ironic thing is that this is not an Islamist regime. This is not an ideological regime. This, if anything, is the carcass of a left-wing regime. But it is a lie that has been a lie for 30 years with the mullahs. And whoever replaces it, even if it's the Muslim Brotherhood, will break that tie. So it might become more Islamic, but it'll be less pro-Iranian.
But as it becomes more Islamic, there's the danger of it becoming more Islamist as well. And that poses yet another or an additional threat to Israel, does it not?
I would say if I were an Israeli strategist, I would take the deal. I would take an Islamist ruler in Damascus, but break the bond with Tehran.
Now, this also has bearing upon one of the military forces that confronts Israel in the north and endangers it, namely Hezbollah.
Yes,
explain that connection, if you would.
Well, Hezbollah was created by the Iranians 30 years ago. And has been very successful as an Islamist party and militia in Lebanon. The Hezbollah phenomenon has been popular in Syria, starting with Bashar al-Assad, who looked up to Hassan Nasrallah, the head of it, with awe. But now that Nasrallah is coming out in favor of the Syrians have been trampling on Hezbollah flags and just sick of the whole thing. So there's a very anti-Iranian and, by extension, anti-Hezbollah sentiment being seen on the streets of Syria today.
What is the connection of all of this to what happened in Egypt? Did Egypt sort of light the spark for them, provide a model which then activated all of those who were deeply discontented within Syria?
Well, the Egyptian coup d'etat, as I will call it, amplified the Tunisian coup d'etat.
That's where it began, yes.
It began in Tunisia, but the remarkable thing about those two cases, and I call them coup d'etats, not revolutions, is because in both cases, they're really quite parallel. The security establishment in Tunisia, the military establishment in Egypt, rather similar, said to their respective presidents, Ben Ali and Mubarak, enough. You are too unpopular, you're too costly, we don't like you anymore, out you go. And in the Egyptian case, there was also the added irritation that Mubarak wanted his son to succeed him.
Yeah.
Not another general, but his son. And Egypt has been, since 1952, a military dictatorship with Naguib, Nasser, Sadat, Mubarak, and now Tantawi. And the military said, no, thanks. You know, we don't want your son, the banker. We want another military man, and that's what they have. So it started in Tunisia. It was amplified in Egypt. But those two were easy because the protesters on the street merely gave a reason, a rationale, for the security military establishments to get rid of their longtime bosses.
Or were the protesters on the street possibly also secretly sponsored and egged on by the military?
I don't think so, no. There's no evidence of that. These were spontaneous, rather liberal, modern, moderate, really quite exciting.
And secular in intent?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a reality. The fact that they didn't take power, and they're not about to take power anywhere soon, does not diminish the importance of this emergence of a modern secular voice in both Tunisia and Egypt.
Some of those are socialist states, we know, or presumed to consider themselves socialist states. We, of course, are not yet a socialist state. And so here on this program, Daniel, as you can well anticipate, we have to stop and serve capitalism every so often. So we'll do that right now for a few commercials and then directly back. And I want to, let me raise this question in advance of our return in a few minutes, focusing now back in on Egypt and the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood, apparently, to considerable power. And also the party that Mubarak considered his own is leagued with them, I gather. I gather this from reading one of your recent essays. So let's zero in and put our focus on Egypt for a little bit after we pause for these messages.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And a few more words about our guest tonight, Daniel Pipes, who is what used to be called an Arabist. That is, he knows the Arab world very well. He spent much time there, years in study. Indeed, he once wrote a book on colloquial Egyptian Arabic. He is, of course, fluent in the Arabic language. He and I have been on one or two different faculties together. Not that we were colleagues. Dan ranks as an historian. I rank as something called a social psychologist. But Daniel Pipes was at the University of Chicago from 1978 to 1982, went back to Harvard, from which he has his PhD, to teach from 83 to 84, and then was on the then taught at the Naval War College. That's the other institution where he and I have both done some work. He more time there than I, and I earlier than he was there. And in 1983, he served on the policy planning staff at the State Department. And it was 1986, was it not, when you left academic life as such, though of course you still go back and lecture at many universities, to found the Middle East Forum, which is based in Philadelphia.
I was at another think tank before that, but yes, I joined the think tank world at that point.
Yeah.
To the month.
And we come then, if we may, well, I should say, for those who may not recognize the name, well, they don't look at television very much, because you've been all over television for many years with guest appearances focused on Middle Eastern affairs. And, of course, for those who are scholarly or quasi-scholarly, Daniel Pipes can be read in all sorts of political journals and journals of international affairs with excellent columns. Indeed, you find them, of course, on the website as well and on the Internet. Just enter his name and there they are. Now then, back to Egypt. Is the Muslim Brotherhood coming into dominance?
No, I don't think so. I mentioned that the military has been in charge since 1952. That was a revolution. There was a monarchy under the with some relations with the British, complex relations, capitalist, Western-oriented, and the so-called free officers under Nasser overthrew the monarchy and put in the place a very different regime, which is still there. Now, it's no longer socialist and Arab nationalist in the same way, but it still is the military, and the military has expanded its rule in many ways. For example, now has a substantial part of the Egyptian economy under its sway. So he is military rule, and
the protesters are back in Tahrir Square protesting that the military are betraying the revolution they thought they had achieved.
Precisely. In other words, the protesters thought they had dumped Mubarak.
Yeah.
But they didn't. They gave a pretext to the military officers to dump Mubarak, The military officer says, I'm making concessions. For example, the trial of Mubarak that's currently underway. But the really key power bases remain the same. The military, the economic bases remain the same. There's really no fundamental change between Mubarak and Tantawi. I don't see any coming.
Is it possible, Daniel, that they will offer the protesters the head of Mubarak, that they will execute him after this trial?
I don't think so, but it's possible. If they feel that that's what they need to do to get the protesters off their back, they might well do it. The key is that the military wants to stay in power and is no more prone to give up power to the Muslim Brotherhood or other Islamist Salafis than it is to the liberal Tahrir Square protesters.
You have been very interested in Islam and Islamism and the two or three different movements within Islam, the traditional version of Islam and the Islamist version, and certainly you see them in continuing conflict in the world, in the Middle East, and certainly even in this country, where they vie for control of the many mosques that keep proliferating around the country. Are the generals, are the military in Egypt essentially given to Islamism, or are they in fact also secular and resistant to it, as are, for example, the military of Turkey?
The military of Egypt is not staunchly secular like the military of Turkey. The military of Turkey is the heir and the keeper of the flame of Ataturk's secular legacy. Mm-hmm. Nothing like that in Egypt. Indeed, quite the contrary. The three officers I mentioned earlier who took over in 1952 came out of an Islamist organization. They are, they're different degrees of Islam. It would be like looking at socialism and communism. You have, say, at one end, Enver Hoxha or Mao Zedong, or Stalin, extremely violent, totally dictatorial. And then you'll have modified versions of it. I don't know. Very polite or Hungarian leaders or Tito. They're all communists, but they have different styles.
Yeah.
And likewise, you had communists in the West, who, had they ever come to power, presumably would not have had a gulag. So you have different temperaments within the same movement. And likewise, in the Islamist movement, you have the extremists like bin Laden, the Salafis more broadly, and you have others who are, like the Muslim Brotherhood, willing to work within the system to say things to appease and defang their opposition, and are much more supple than the extremists. And in this light, the military is rather Islamist. For example, the current constitution of Egypt was put in place, I believe, in 1981 by the military, by Sadat. The constitution that mentions that the Sharia, that Islamic law, is the source of the constitution of Egypt. That's something that the military put in. So it's not Salafi, it's not extremist within the Islamist movement, but it is totalitarian and fundamentally wants to apply the Sharia, the Islamic law, is hostile to the West. Now you have someone like Sadat move away from that. Tantawi, I think, is moving back a bit towards that. Over six decades you have variations. But I would not see the Egyptian military these days so much as ideological as it is self-interested. And this, I think, is the key to the Middle East. Nearly everywhere, under the patina of one ideology or another, you find that the ruler's main preoccupation is staying in power and benefiting from the perks of power. That's what politics is about in the Middle East.
Daniel, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And until now, when one has replaced the other, it's simply been a new dictator enjoying the perks of power.
Now, the question that arises is the question that we used to ask, sort of mocking our immigrant parents back in Brooklyn when I was a kid. If the Dodgers have won the pennant, our grandfathers might have said, is that good for the Jews? And the question I'm raising right now, even as we're about to pause once again for a quick update on the news and then directly back to you, is all of this good or bad for Israel? Israel itself, at this very moment, has a rather surprising eruption of popular protest, and people are striking and sitting on in the streets, much as they did in Tahrir Square. We need to talk about that as well. But as we look at the Arab Middle East in ferment and in change, one necessarily must raise the question, as they surely do in the foreign ministry in Tel Aviv, is how does all of this bear upon our prospects and about our need, still our hope, even though it has faded some over the many years, to resolve the conflict with the Palestinians and get them to accept our presence as a legitimate and friendly state. I want to return to all of that just to get your thoughts on how this bears upon the future and the prospects of Israel. Right after we pause for that update on the news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Daniel Pipes, what I was urging upon you a few minutes ago, Dan, was simply the question of taking all of what is happening in the surrounding Arab states, how does that bear upon the problems and prospects for the state of Israel?
Well, Milt, it's too early to say. Should this round of upheavals damage the regime in Tehran or lead to its overthrow, then it would be a huge plus for Israel as well as everybody else, including the Iranians themselves. But if it doesn't, and leads to turmoil in the region that radicalizes the peoples of the region, then it could end up worse. But it's just too early to say. Who knows what's going to happen in Yemen, what's going to happen in Libya, et cetera. It's too early. Saudi Arabia could be in play. Who knows?
Apparently, the more it changes, the more it changes, rather than the more it stays the same. There's an awful lot of dynamic in the Middle East, and one doesn't really know where this whole process is taking the country. There was the hope, there was the aspiration. It was a journalistic interpretation from the West looking on. Ah, at last democracy is coming spontaneously and rising from the ground in the Middle East. That isn't quite the case, is it?
Well, it's not entirely wrong. No, it's not the case, but it's not entirely wrong. You know, we saw in the early part of 2011, in particular, an emergence of a liberal modern spirit and its advocates. Now, they are remote from the corridors of power, but they did find each other, they did express this. This has potentially great importance for the future, but it's a long way off future. For now, no. Yet indeed, I mentioned offhand before Yemen. Yemen strikes me as a country that could do a lot of damage to the region. It's a country that's on the precipice, economically, militarily, religiously, geographically. There are so many things that can go wrong in Yemen. Could lead to an outflow of refugees stabilizing. One shudders to think what the consequences might be. This didn't start in 2011, but it's reaching. It might be reaching its climax.
And they had a strong al-Qaeda. They have a strong al-Qaeda segment within Yemen. It's called al-Qaeda in Yemen, is it not? Or on the Arabian Peninsula.
On the Arabian Peninsula, right. Yeah. And yes, there is. There are tribal, religious, regional, ideological divisions in Yemen. The country is, as I said, economically on the precipice. One shudders to think what might follow.
Now, back to Israel itself. What are all those people sitting on the ground for in Tel Aviv this very day or night?
Well, let me start by putting in context. You mentioned earlier that we're not quite a socialist country yet, but we're moving towards socialism. And there are a lot of Americans who don't like that, who don't want the government interfering. And they're called usually the Tea Party. It's a reaction. Mm-hmm. Government, get off my back, get out of my life. That's the American response. In Greece and in Israel and in much of Europe, the response is the opposite. They say, government, give me what I'm due. Government, I want my benefits. I want my pension. I want to retire at 50. I want full health coverage. I want free schools and so forth. And that's what you're seeing in Israel.
We do see that happening elsewhere in Europe, in Greece, and even for that matter, in France. And
Indeed.
And so on.
And in London.
And London, of course. This very night, to be sure.
Right.
But one had the impression that in Israel a decided turn towards the right had been taken with the elevation of Netanyahu. And until recently, he was very, very strong in the polls and supposedly had helped develop, to use a German term, a Wirtschaftswunder, a great surge forward in terms of a new industry, particularly in the broad realm of electronics and information sciences. And we were told they were flourishing and that people were really at last fulfilled and getting richer.
They are indeed. And you're right to point to Netanyahu, though not Netanyahu the prime minister, not 96-99, not since 2009. No, it was Netanyahu the finance minister under Sharon in the early part of last decade.
Who got this Wirtschaftswunder going, yes.
Yeah. So there's no question Israel is doing very well. It has one of the highest growth rates in the world. It was barely affected by the Great Recession of 2008. And as a result, there's a premium on housing. And also there are still socialist elements to the economy. While it was opened up, there's still important parts of it that are distorted by the remnants of socialism. And so part of this is anti-socialist. For example, it began with in general, it's about the price of living. It's expensive in Israel. People are making good money, but they're also paying a lot more than we do. Everything from cars to housing to cottage cheese. I mean, this began with cottage cheese, of all things. And it's people saying, hey, government, I want to pay less and get more. It's so different from us, because you don't have people in the country saying, hey, government, I want more benefits. You have people in this country saying, hey, government, get out of my life.
Is there also in Israel at last a kind of an emerging class conflict? Israel now has a new class of super millionaires and billionaires, and that may be generating some kind of resentment from below. Is that right?
There certainly is a wider differentiation economically today than a generation or two ago. Yes, there were no billionaires in Israel in the old days, but the standard of living is much higher than it used to be. I find this a kind of spoiled brat phenomenon, in that people, you know, want to have cheaper housing, and they're turning to the government and saying, "I want cheaper housing." I mean, well, it's not exactly the right way to go about things.
This has obviously energized the remnants of the Labour Party. Tzipi Livni, who was the foreign minister in the prior government, today was pronouncing a full blessing upon Barack Obama's call for a return to the 67 borders as the way of settling with the Palestinians.
Right, but now we're talking about international politics, not domestic.
To be sure.
And by the way, Livni comes out of Likud, same party as Netanyahu, not Labor.
Is that so?
Yeah, she was a big wheel in the Likud party. Yes, one of the games that the left in Israel has played for many years is to club the right, now in international politics, with the United States or with foreign pressure. There's a constant theme of the left pleading with Americans in particular to force the Likud government, the right-wing government, to make changes. The most remarkable illustration of that was a few years ago when the editor of a left-wing newspaper called Haaretz said to the then Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, please rape us.
Yeah.
Please force the government of Israel to do your will. It's usually not that baldly stated, but that's, in effect, what Livni has been saying is, please, Obama, put pressure on Netanyahu to make him follow the kind of policy that we in the Kadima party want.
Now, in that context, a necessary question, just before we pause for some commercials and then on to the phones, and let me interrupt myself to invite our listeners to get in there with some questions. If they want to do so, do it quickly. 312-591-7200. The lines are open right now. 312-591-7200. The leftover and necessary question is there yet or at last any basis for thinking that some kind of true resolution between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, so-called, might really be achieved, that a settlement is potentially available only a few years down the road, or maybe even sooner. Is that believable in any way?
No, it's not. If anything, it's less believable than it has been in the past.
Why? Why is it less so?
Well, Obama has quite a bit to do with it, because what he said to the Israelis is, unless you stop doing X and Y, we'll really be upset with you. And the Palestinians said, yeah, us too, no X and Y.
Yeah.
Well, X and Y meant more conditions that hadn't been there before, that the Palestinians hadn't demanded before. And so the Obama administration has created more difficulties for diplomacy than had existed back under Bush. But even then, I mean, I'm of the opinion that the only way the Arab-Israeli conflict will be resolved is when one side gives up on its goals. Either the Israelis give up on the goal of a sovereign Jewish state, or the Palestinians give up on their goal of eliminating the sovereign Jewish state.
Yeah.
I don't believe that you can find an interim resolution. One side has to give up, and I believe the Palestinians should give up. And I think Israeli and American and worldwide policy should be directed towards getting the Palestinians to give up their foul goal of trying to eliminate the state of Israel.
Why have the Palestinians not yet given up on that goal?
There's no reason for them to give up. They're given money and arms and diplomatic support and passionate political support around the world. They're the favorite from the United Nations to the faculty lounge.
So the faculty lounge, indeed, including the faculty lounge for the Middle East Studies Center at the university where you taught for a while and where I've taught
precisely
for a long, long time. That reminds me of a very interesting paper of yours, or article that I read only today off the internet, in which you evaluate Middle East studies programs in the West. And you're very critical of them, but there's no time for that right now. Time to necessarily pause for a quick round of commercials, and then to the phones, 312-591-7200, also for email, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Any question you want to raise, any thought you want to share, if only briefly, do give us a ring, 312-591-7200.
Milt Rosenberg and extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And we return directly to Daniel Pipes, and I see we have more email than we have phone calls, so I'll read some of that email. But for those who are tempted to call, act on that temptation instantly. 312-591-7200 for any question or you want to pose or any thought you want to share. 312-591-7200. Vasilis sends this email. How do you feel about President Obama supporting the radical element Palestinians in requesting that Israel move its borders back to the pre-1967 war? Of course, you've already said something about that, but let's elaborate that a little. You think that really, that statement by Obama in a speech just a little while ago, essentially incentivized the Palestinians still further to resist the possibility of moving towards settlement?
Precisely. That was why, and the X and Y I mentioned. The X was demanding the Israelis stop building in the West Bank and even in eastern Jerusalem. The Y was this demand that the Israelis accept the 1967 borders as the base for land swaps. In both cases, Obama took an issue that no one was thinking about, and that the centerpiece of U.S.-Israel relations, and also gave it to the Palestinians as a new demand. And thus, despite his urgency to resolve this issue, has made it more difficult than ever.
In the days when you were at the University of Chicago, when you and I were in a sort of a foreign affairs discussion group that met once a month, I guess, did you come to know Rashid Khalidi?
No, I don't think he was there then.
He came only later.
I think so.
Of course, you know that he had clearly a close relationship to Barack Obama when Barack Obama taught in the law school.
Oh, yes.
And supposedly, well, do you think that Khalidi and, for that matter, Edward Said managed to exert any influence on shaping the attitudes of Barack Obama, attitudes which he took from long ago and far away on forward into the presidency.
Yes, I would make a distinction. On the one hand, there is who Barack Obama genuinely is in his heart, and clearly he's from the far left. Clearly he's someone who consorted with people like Khalid Said and also Ali Abu Nima, extreme anti-Israel elements, clear and obvious. But as he's risen as a politician, he has pushed this aside. Now, maybe in his heart he's still of that disposition, but in his policies, I mean, these are not people in the government. His policies are much more mainstream Democratic Party policies than they are the people I just mentioned. Who knows? In a second term, he might show his hand more, express his heart more. But so far, there have been no radical changes in U.S. policy. Indeed, while on the one hand, Barack Obama has made things worse, for diplomacy by adding these two elements that we've talked about. The Israelis are unanimous in saying that the arms relationship, the military relationship, is better than ever, and in particular better than under Bush. So it's not that clear that he is espousing the views he had when he was out of office. You know, to a certain extent, where you stand is where you sit. And if you're president, you are limited in a number of ways. You have to. You're not the only factor. If you're an academic, you can come up with any policy you like. If you're a freewheeling intellectual, you can come up with any policy you like. But if you're a politician, you have to work within certain boundaries, and he is doing that.
You know, it's worth noting, if we can just turn to some personal angles for a moment, that a very close lieutenant of his, and indeed somebody who helped to mount his political career, was for a while... assisted him very closely, of course, in the first 2 years of his presidency. But this same person, whom I've not yet mentioned, was earlier in his life a member of the armed forces of the State of Israel. And whether he had held joint citizenship or not, I don't know. But he's rather loyal to Israel and its role in the world. And that person is now the mayor of the city of Chicago.
Well, Israelis have a lot of different viewpoints. Veterans of the Israeli Defense Forces have many different viewpoints.
Yeah.
You could well be a veteran of the IDF and espouse the kind of policies that Obama has. It doesn't make you a member of Likud.
And in fact, some generals, retired generals, have signed a petition, in essence, supporting that view, haven't they?
Right. Chase has its list of Israeli generals.
Yeah. Let's talk for just a minute, though, about... what I signaled earlier and what so fascinated me when I read it today, your assessment of Middle East studies in the Western world.
Can you give me a lead? Which angle you're...
Well, you essentially think that they have been decisively pro-Palestinian and anti-Israeli for the last three or four decades, I guess.
I see. Well, I put it into a larger context that the traditional liberal university has... since my generation of the 1960s, become radicalized. And one of the essences of the radicalism is to dislike the United States, to criticize and dump on the United States, and to be sympathetic to the enemies of the United States,
yeah.
And to dump on the allies of the United States, not just Israel. And so what one finds in Middle Eastern academic circles is a tendency to apologize for Saddam Hussein or Ayatollah Khomeini or others who are anti-American, anti-Israel, and to criticize those who are pro-Israel. And that is not just Middle East studies and not just Israel, but it is a general feature, and it comes to bear on the Middle East and Israel in this way. But it is rampant. It is nearly universal.
Yeah, so it's part
I would say 95% of the academics in the Middle East studies field resist this point of view.
Yeah. And in that, they're lodged within within a larger context of sort of Marxoid sentiment, which characterizes many of the social science and even of the humanities departments in American university life.
In university life worldwide.
Yeah. But yet you suggested in that same piece that I read only earlier that maybe there's a pattern of the wind of change may be blowing through Middle Eastern studies as such.
Yes, I think Middle Eastern studies is benefiting from something unique to it, namely two major events, 9/11 and the Iraq and Afghan wars. And each of them has created a cadre of individuals, the first focused on Islam, the second focused on geopolitics, that is much more mainstream. Or to put it differently, in the late 1940s, if someone to make a career in international affairs, Russia and the Soviet Union were the best way to get ahead. Today, in the last decade, it's been the Middle East and Islam. And so what one finds is lots of ambitious types, quite different from the historic type who went into Middle East studies, who are entering this field and making it more mainstream and less left-wing than it has been.
Well, we've come to the end of the available time. How I do wish we had another hour to continue this.
Well, thank you.
Are you ever in or near Chicago these days, Dan?
I am indeed sometimes.
Do please let me know next time that you're going to be around in town, and let's do a full two-hour program here, if possible.
Okay, well, thank you for the invitation.
Oh, I thank you so much for joining us tonight as well. It's been very, very valuable. And
thank
we'll you. Say with that, we'll say goodnight to our very special guest of the evening, Daniel Pipes, who, though I'm eager to direct all who want to know more of Dan Pipes' thought and share also the work of his very important foundation or his very important think tank, to go to the Middle East Forum on the Internet. Simply that, enter it on Google, Middle East Forum, and you'll get loads of interesting articles and much illumination of what's moving in that part of the world. We'll be back again tomorrow night, again with a one-hour program following a ball game, this coming at 11, and another man whom I much respect and regard concerning, in general, his views of the world's affairs, and particularly of military affairs, on which he is an expert. This is Victor Davis Hanson of the Hoover Institution, also out in California, a columnist syndicated by the Chicago Tribune, as it happens, and also a classic scholar. Fabulous fellow. He'll be our guest tomorrow at 11. Until then, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night to all.